The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 267 for Monday, June 14th, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. Here from Durham, New Hampshire, home from WWDC, I am Dave Hamilton. And on the other end of the Skype connection is...
John Efron in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome home, Dave.
Thanks. And I want to wish you a happy fifth anniversary, because yesterday marked the 5th year since we started doing this podcast. It was June 13th, 2005, that we did Mac Geek Gab number one. Which actually at the time wasn't even called Mac Geek. Oh, I guess it was called Mac Geek Gab. Yes, it was. It was that name came in about an hour before we recorded that episode, if memory serves.
Wow.
Yeah.
Five.
I know.
What'd you get me?
I got you Mac Geek Gab number 267. What'd you get me?
Same thing. I'll treasure it always.
Yes, that's right. Of course.
All right. As usual, we got way more stuff here.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's go with, we just hired a new salesperson here at Backbeat Media. John Donahue is starting tomorrow. And so, I was at WWDC last week. So yesterday and today I was going through the process of setting up a computer for him and was doing it with a MacBook Pro and wound up doing some migrations and kind of repurposing a couple of machines in the process. And it was the first time I'd really done this since I got Snow Leopard. And Snow Leopard makes this process a little bit different. The first thing, and I'm starting at the bottom of our agenda list here, John. The first thing is that there is no erase and install option. So, you know, if I had a machine that I wanted to completely wipe and put a fresh copy of Snow Leopard on, it is not obvious how to do that. What you have to do is boot from the installer CD or DVD rather. And then once you get the installer up, you go to the utilities menu, you choose disk utility. And then from there you either erase or repartition, which also causes an erase, of the drive in the computer. And once it's erased, then you quit disk utility and you're brought back to the installer, at which point you can walk through the installation. And so the Snow Leopard installer does not do the erase and install. You have to do the erase manually, then it'll do an install, and then that install is now a fresh install, and it'll ask you about Migration Assistant and all that other stuff when it comes up. But the first time I did it, I just kind of walked through because I was waiting for the prompt, right? You know, you wait for that little options button. It's just no longer there. So I wound up installing it twice because I'm like, well, wait a minute, why does it still have all this old? Oh yeah, you know. So it's very interesting that they pulled that out. I get why they did it. I mean, they wanted to simplify the whole process. But very interesting that's what it was. Any comments there, John? You with me still? Skype's
still
working?
I'm with you.
Okay. Well, I rely on your comments as an opportunity for me to sip my tea. But so once I had that up and running, of course, the Migration Assistant did come up. And the message with the Migration Assistant was initially what I wanted to do was migrate. I wanted to set up one machine, migrate all the stuff from another, and then wipe the second machine. So when it came up, you know, you have an option where you can, in the installer, before you even start the installation, you can go to the utilities menu, and all the way at the bottom is restore from a backup. And what that'll let you do is hit the restore from a time machine backup. But it's very clear on that screen that you should not restore from a backup from another machine. It should be the same machine, or at least at the very least, the same model machine, and not a different processor, not a different motherboard, etc. So I did not do that. If you want to restore from a time machine backup from another computer, what you do is you install Snow Leopard first. Then when the Migration Assistant comes up, instead of pointing it, you have a couple of options with the Migration Assistant, and you can point it. One of the options is you can point it at a time machine backup from another computer and migrate stuff in from there. You can also point it at a disk image from another computer. And of course, if both computers have FireWire, you can use FireWire target disk mode to migrate the stuff over, which is the traditional migration assistant path, where you set one computer in target disk mode by holding down T when it boots and then pulling that data over, treating that other computer just like it's an external hard drive at that point.
Or, of course, because I ran into this when I helped upgrade mom from the old trusty iBook G4 to the brand new MacBook. Of course, the new MacBook doesn't have a FireWire port on
it. Right. Oh, you can do Ethernet, can't you?
Yes, exactly. And in this case, the fastest connection was actually, now the only other thing is that when the iBook came out, 100 base T was state of the art. So it was 100 base T connection. So it took a while, but it was the fastest connection, and actually the only connection really between the two machines to accomplish that.
Got it. Yeah, that's right. So you can do network, and you could do you don't have to do Ethernet. I think you can also do wireless, right? If they're both associated to the same wireless network at that point.
Yeah, but of course, you know, the wireless, especially on the older machine, was it was not the fastest option.
That's right.
But yeah, I guess you're right. I don't recall seeing that. It usually makes it pretty explicit. Okay, either hook up a network cable or a FireWire. But
yeah,
you're right. So yeah. I'm glad they had at least one port in common, because I'm not too happy with them, you know, pulling that FireWire port out.
But yeah, I guess
they got to differentiate between the machines, right?
I guess. But so you know, the other thing that you could do is make, and I always do this whenever I'm repurposing a computer, is before I wipe it, I'd make a disk image of it, and I just save that off somewhere on some big, you know, FireWire drive or a Drobo or something like that, where I know that I have a, you know, last use case disk image of that machine archived off somewhere. And I'll keep that for several years. And then, finally, like when I was doing it last night, I realized I had some that were a couple of years old and I just trashed them because I don't need them anymore. But that has come in handy 3-4 months down the road. Like, oh yeah, that thing I used to do that for whatever reason, Migration Assistant didn't, you know, beam it across. It's like, yep, no problem. I just mount the drive, go get what I need. It's all right there at my fingertips. And it saves a lot of headache. So you could, from the disk utility, at the very start, you boot up from the Snow Leopard DVD or Leopard or Tiger, you know, whatever you're doing, go to the utilities menu, choose disk utility. And from there, you can restore from a disk image. Again, Apple doesn't recommend this because they don't know if you're going to have the right stuff to boot the new machine from the disk of the old machine. But in the old days, this is what we used to do all the time, John, right? You know, you get a new machine and you just clone it from the old one, pre-migration assistant days. You just clone the whole drive and then go and reinstall Snow Leopard on top of that. But you don't have to do that anymore, thanks to Migration Assistant. But that was the simplest way to get all your stuff over and then make sure you had an OS. It wasn't entirely clean, but it worked. And it still, in theory, would work. You just have to boot again from the DVD to put an operating system on there. So
yeah, that's what I did too. And this upgrade is pretty much, you know, did a carbon copy cloner.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the drive in the old machine. And they actually donated, the old machine to charity. So the old machine's not even around anymore. In addition to donating their old, she actually kept the old toilet seat.
iBook.
Remember those?
I do.
That was a G3, so that's from way back. So they were able to donate those and get a couple hundred bucks right off.
Good. All right. Moving on to George's question here, because it's so related to what we just talked about.
Hi, guys. George from Willow Springs. How you doing? Hey, I got an interesting problem. I just upgraded my machine to a MacBook Pro. From a MacBook Pro, but this is now the new one with the black keyboard and the i5 chip. And interestingly enough, my FireWire 2 or FireWire 800 external drive, which has a bootable 10.6.3 Snow Leopard volume on it, no longer boots, nor does a 10.5.2 6 or whatever the last version of Leopard is, that doesn't boot either. So I'm wondering why in the world that would be. These are both Intel chips. I wonder if they snuck in a new kernel into 10.6 as a function of these new i5 and i7 chips. Maybe you can help me out on that. Have a great day.
Thanks, George. Doing a little bit of research online, you are not alone, George. There are many people reporting the same thing, and indeed, there is a different build of 10.6.3 that is on those new MacBook Pros. I guess Apple didn't have, you know, a 10.6.4 or whatever's next in the pipeline, or at the right spot in the pipeline to bundle with those machines. But that is a different processor. Even though we've seen i5s and i7s before, as we talked about, this is a different flavor of the i5 and i7 than is in the iMac. So not all that surprising that the previous build of OS X just simply didn't have the guts to support it. So
I'm kind of surprised.
Are you?
I mean, I don't know if the i5 or i7 is, you know, a massive departure from, you know, the prior chips, other than the, you know, hyper threading, you know, as
right.
we talked about earlier. So it does kind of surprise me that that the new chip doesn't understand targeted for it. Kind of surprised me.
Well, you know, it looking at it a different way, it may be that the code for the OS says, if your chip ID is this, do it this way. If your chip ID is that, do it that way, right? And this has a chip ID that matches something that doesn't have the capabilities of that the OS expects, right? It's not the same i5 or the same i7 that we had in the iMac. So there might have been a simple little nuance or a simple little, you know, compilation time switch that made the kernel happy to run on these chips. So.
And of course, the way that typically, well, there are two ways. I assume he tried, you know, both. Well, I think he mentioned this. Yeah. So, you know, when you start up your machine, you hold down Option and it shows you all potentially eligible bootable devices, or you want to be sure to, of course, explicitly select it and start up this. We've talked about that. Otherwise, a lot of machines will default to NetBoot, which I have never run into anybody that actually uses that, but which looks for a bootable device on the network, which I think usually most people don't, or it's a NetBoot server, I guess is how they do that.
Yeah, I've done it with the Hackintosh machine here, and it works fine.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it works. All right, I want to talk about our first sponsor here, John, and that is Barebone Software with Yojimbo, specifically the new Yojimbo version 2.2. So Yojimbo is an app that allows you to collect everything that you wouldn't put anywhere else. All those text files of data that you've got, all those PDFs that are just sort of cluttering your desktop, but you don't want to throw them away. You throw them all into Yojimbo, and then you can categorize, you can search. It holds everything all together. I use it to organize our show notes. I put PDFs of the emails that we read in there. I have one file that winds up being a rich text file that I build the agenda in, and then also drag in the audio files like George's that we just played, and it ties it all together. And then of course it syncs via Mobile Me, even though I'm having a problem syncing via Mobile Me right now. But that's no great surprise because that's how Mobile Me goes. You can also sync with your Dropbox. And that indeed has proven very reliable for me. The new Yojimbo has something called Sidekick, which makes most of your Yojimbo data available as web pages. And you can use that preference pane to tell Yojimbo which items it should export and where it should put that exported content. And what you can do is you could put that on your Dropbox, you could put it on your Mobile Me, you know, web page, you could put it on your personal web server, and then you can access your Yojimbo data from your iPad, your iPhone, or any, you know, Mac that's, you know, or even Windows machine, anything that's got a web browser. So that's Yojimbo version 2.2 from Barebones at barebones.com. Yojimbo, of course, is available for a free trial for 30 days. Once you're totally hooked at the end of the 30 days, it's $39. And you can do a family pack for $69. Or if you're a student, you can do it for $29 with the educational deal. So that's Yojimbo from Barebones Software at barebones.com. You know, while we're here, I do want to mention, and there'll be an article going up at TMO. I've got a couple of people interested in the position of webmaster here at TMO. As I mentioned, our own Stephen Swift is heading off in the fall to grad school. And so we are looking for someone to step into that role. I was going to say step into his shoes, but everybody's shoes are different here at TMO. We all kind of do different things. So we're looking for someone to come in and bring their own skill set. But certainly in that LAMP world. And if you don't know what LAMP is, then you're probably not the right person for the job. But but if you know what LAMP is, we use that. We, you know, Expression Engine is our core. We also do some FileMaker stuff, but really we're looking for somebody that can come in, do some LAMP, JavaScript, CSS stuff for us and just help keep everything running smoothly. So if you are interested and available, it's Dave at MacObserver.com is the right email address to send that to. That and only that. The rest of the stuff goes off to the other one because that way it gets to John and I. But yeah, if you're interested, send me an email and I'll be putting a note up on TMO hopefully tomorrow. I've got a lot going on. Like I said, we're starting a new employee at Backbeat Media tomorrow. So things are a little bit hectic around here. But we're here, so that's a good thing. Should we go on to Tiari? I think I've got the name pronunciation right. Did I get that right?
Put it in there. I don't know.
I think it's Tiari. Yeah. All right, so we'll go on to Tiari. And he says, this problem has me baffled. I receive PDFs by email daily from various banking institutions that I use for my work. Some of these emails come in as an embedded PDF, and they're fine. But sometimes they come in showing 0 bytes and the PDF is blank. The second part happens quite often. My email setup is as follows. I have a number of POP3 addresses. My main Gmail account collects them all and forwards them to my MobileMe account. On Mail.app, I just have a MobileMe account. It works like a charm except for this problem. I'm not sure what I installed then other than mail tags. And lately, I'm not sure. Okay, there's some English issue here, but I use mail tags and Mail Acton to move emails around using rules, but I'm not sure that that's the problem. Under MobileMe Beta Online, the bad emails do not have the size of the PDF, but it shows uploading. Because this problem happens from various sources, I assume that it's my system that's causing it. Can you think of anything? All right. First of all, I don't think it's your system that's causing it, because if it was, your issue would not show up in the webmail interface at MobileMe. So it's not your Mac that's causing it, but it may be your system of email management that's causing it. Gmail does have that pop slurper or whatever it calls it, where it a pop fetcher, where it goes out and fetches pop mail from all these various clients and funnels it into Gmail. I'd be curious if, you know, start honoring the troubleshooting process, right? Step back through the chain at various steps and see, okay, look, you know, we know they're not getting to your computer. It also sounds like they're not getting to MobileMe. So let's go back one step further. You know, don't forward them out of Gmail. And now let's see, are they in Gmail? If they aren't, okay, well, now take a step back to the POP account and, you know, trace this back and find out what's going on. At the very least, maybe try subscribing to one of these with just your MobileMe account. So it's going straight there and you're bypassing this, you know, this Rube Goldberg email thing and see, right? You know, it's a troubleshooting process and you have to kind of take it one step at a time. Right, John. I mean, that's what we preach anyway. Don't change too many things. Don't change more than one thing at once, because then you don't know what fixed it. If you do it, wind up, in fact, fixing it.
Right. I mean, it could be that whoever's providing the PDFs, maybe that thing is barfing and you are, in fact, getting 0 byte PDF attachments.
Right. That's right. Yeah. You might be getting the email exactly as it came from. I was going to say as intended, but that's not as intended. But you might be getting it exactly as it came from them. That's right.
Yeah, because you know, I'm sure they're using some automated system to suck up data, and maybe the, you know, database connection or something is broken, and it's not smart enough to figure out it's sending out nothing. So, one remote thing is that you know, he's forwarding attachments, and it sounds like it's going through a number of different pipes.
Yeah,
and a lot of mail servers. I don't know if this is the case, but it's worth discussing.
I think it is. Yeah.
Well, a lot of times attachments, various mail servers, and I actually ran into this the other day, was actually trying to send an email, which had a attachment of a log on the Mac, and actually I got a bounce message from the people saying, up the log file's too big. And I'm like, guys, anyways. Now, in that case, the remote mail server actually did say, sorry, dude, the limit for attachments is, you know, however many megabytes. You know, and usually I think most mail servers, because, you know, mail servers really were not intended, although they're used for this still, are really not intended to be transferring files. They're really meant to be transferring text. But, you know, it's all hobbled together. So maybe one or more mail servers along the way said, you know, this is too big. It should reject it, but maybe instead of doing that, it passed on what it thought was important and just didn't deliver the attachment. You know, another fun thing you could do is actually log. Now, we don't want to suggest logging directly into the mail server and trying to list the message, which will show you the encoded MIME content, because you could be there for years.
Yes. Yeah. Unless you're really comfortable with POP. Yeah, that could get. And even if you are, that could get messy. I'm not sure. You know, your best bet would be, I'm trying to think of what it was. And maybe it was MailSmith. Old client, it used to be Barebones Software, but then essentially Barebones disowned it, which meant that Rich Siegel, the founder and CEO of Barebones, and as he calls himself, the chief typist, it took it over on his own. So it is still supported in a way, but what it had, among many other things, is it had kind of a POP inspector where you could use this windowed interface to look at what was on your POP server without actually downloading it first. Right. So you could really manipulate and see what was going on. So that would be one thing to do, is actually, you know, because it'll pull down the headers and kind of show you different things that are going on. That might be helpful. But before you do that, you've got to tell Gmail to stop slurping mail from those POP servers, because otherwise it'll pull it out right from underneath you.
Actually, one more thing, Dave?
Yeah.
I'm trying to find it here. You may want to try this. He's using Mail App, and I'm looking right here. I've done this on occasion. This is always fun if you got a lot of time to kill. Is I think it's long headers.
Yeah.
Usually what you see in an email message is an abbreviated version of all the stuff at the beginning. There may be something in the... And let me just click on this. Yes. Okay. So if you click on long header...
Wait, where is he clicking on that?
I'm sorry. So in Mail...
Yep.
View,
right,
message, and you'll either see, it'll either say default headers or long headers.
Right.
There may be something buried in the header that indicates what went wrong, or who's the a lot of times in the long header, you'll see things like, you know, the name of the remote mail server and maybe the program used to generate the PDF and some other fun stuff.
But sure.
It's worth looking in there to see if there's anything out of the ordinary in that long header. So. One more tool to help diagnose the problem.
Yep. Cool. You know, while we're on the subject of Gmail, and I know we're only loosely on that subject, I did want to mention something. John, you and I were talking about Gmail before, and you just happened to mention that you said you're in mail.app. Now, you use mail app to connect to Gmail. You happened to mention that your mail.app's trash folder was filled up with all this Gmail spam. And that triggered a red flag for me because of something that I learned a couple of months ago with how Gmail manages spam. And
right. Because it keeps getting full, and I don't want my mailbox to get full. So I.
Sure. Delete the spam.
And the way I was doing it was to put it in the mail trash.
Right. So what happens is when mail interfaces with Gmail, it's doing it, or at least the way you're doing it, John, is over an IMAP interface. And I'm doing the same thing. And that really is the best way to do it. And I know I've promised this article, it's got to go up by tomorrow because I've got to give it to John Donahue when he starts so that he can configure his Gmail properly. But there's a couple of things you can do in order to make Gmail and IMAP work happily together. The big one is turning on advanced IMAP controls in the Google Labs section and then going into folders and making it so that the all mail folder does not appear to your mail client, because that way you won't start getting duplicate copies of all your mail. So with that, though, you do get access to your spam folder, and it's very handy to go through your spam folder on your Mac. The way Google, because on your Mac, you can sort by subject, and I find that sorting by subject is the best way to go through and find any false positives, right? Anything that the spam folder found that it should not have called spam. So When you're going through and you find a false positive, all you have to do is drag it out of the spam folder into some other folder, presumably your inbox, but it could go anywhere else. And that trains Gmail that it's not spam. Conversely, if you in your inbox find something that you feel is spam, you drag it from your inbox or wherever to the spam folder, and that trains Gmail that it is spam. But it's important to remember that with IMAP, when you delete something, what it does is it takes it from a folder and moves it to another folder called trash. But that folder could be anything. It doesn't have to be trash. It could be whatever you want. So Gmail doesn't necessarily know that you want to trash this message. All it knows is that you've pulled this message out of your spam folder and inadvertently, and at least in your case, John, and probably in many people's cases, you've inadvertently marked that message as not spam. So the proper, did I get that right, John?
I think so.
Okay. All right. The proper way of doing this is, one, I would continue to scour through it on your Mac, because again, you can sort by subject and that's very handy. As soon as you're done scouring through it, go ahead and launch the web interface for Gmail. Click on the spam folder, and then at the top of the spam folder, you'll see a little line that says delete all spam messages. Now, once you've gone through and made sure there's no false, false positives in there, then just click that button or click that link. It's not actually a button. It's looks like just a hyperlink. And that will delete all the spam in your folder. A, it does it without untraining Gmail for you. And B, it does it without filling up your trash mailbox. So you get kind of a double whammy there.
Mm-hmm. All right. I do a couple of different things when I'm filtering. Because, first off, it is just a spam magnet. My gosh. I mean, I get like 100 a day. And it's, the usual sure. Viagra. And, now I'm getting, BP oil spill. You're eligible for compensation, even though I'm in Connecticut. It's wonderful. A lot of times I'll look at the to field. A lot of garbage I see is that the to field is not in fact my address, but something like subscriber.
Right.
Or an address that's not my address. Or the best one sometimes, especially when it's telling me about the large winnings that I just had in the lottery, is a recipient list suppressed.
Right. Of course.
It's like, if I just won the big deal lottery, why are you suppressing the address you're sending it to? Obvious spam. Anyways, Gmail does a wonderful job. I actually take this stuff in there and I train my spam sieve, because I still use spam sieve under mail. So I find that it's an additional training for that.
All right. Cool.
Moving.
All right. Yeah. Moving on to Chris. Chris has has a tip for us and then a question. So Chris writes, for the person with the possible logic board problem in previous show, actually two shows ago, I think I heard he was 1 month out of AppleCare. Apple can and often does still cover that repair if he pleads his case and has some luck with the genius at hand. 1 month is not unusual to extend the warranty, especially considering that this person spent the money on AppleCare to begin with. Even standard warranties are often extended for a month many times. So the lesson here is, if you are just shortly past your AppleCare expiration date, call and beg for mercy, or go person to person if you're doing an appointment at the Genius Bar, and you may very well get covered under AppleCare, even though it's just slightly out of warranty. So that's good to know, Chris. I had not heard that before, but it makes sense. That no reason to drive people crazy over that. So number two, he says, you covered sending out from the ISP. Sending mail out from the ISP and blocking port 25 is really okay. But what about when I'm away from my network? What about when I'm at a hotel or on an Apple Store network? Some ISPs do not let you send mail through them from the outside. They won't even let you authenticate. Okay, so what Chris is talking about here is, let's say, for example, he has Comcast as his ISP when he's at home, and he has his mail server set up to be Comcast's outgoing mail server. And that works fine when he's at home. But as soon as he goes somewhere else, Comcast says, hey, whoa, wait a minute. You're not in my network now, so I don't accept mail from you. And it does that to prevent spam. So the question is, what do you do, or what are the options of things that you can do when you are out and about? So, John, you had a good geeky answer that actually works. It sometimes works. So go ahead and we'll do the geeky answer, and then we'll get to something that's a little more simple on the back end, but not quite.
Well, I got a couple here. So one, I believe some ISPs will provide a authenticated SMTP, where normally they'll detect that you're coming from an external network and say no because of spam. But
right.
I mean, I'm looking in mail here, and this is an option. If you authenticate yourself, you know, give them a username and password, then they may let you use them. But I think most don't do that. And I've never used that myself. But one thing you could do, and I have done this when I traveled and I was using, wanted everything in my current mail client. The thing is, you got to figure out if the place you're at even offers an outgoing mail server. And a lot of places may not. But when I've had to do this, they did. And here's the trick. So you got to figure out the name of it. Well, how do you do that? Well, a lot of times it may be the name of a third party providing the service. But what you can usually do is run something like that. The one that I'd like to use is something called whatismyip.com. And if you run that, surprise, you will see the IP address of they've been assigned, even if it's the outside address. So it'll give you the outside address, which is what you're going to need. And then what you can do is try to do an NS lookup on that. That'll then tell you, and say it's, you know, www.hotel.com. Okay.
Sure.
Not that that's going to be it, or, you know, ISP, hotelisp.com. Okay.
Sure.
Well, I would guess that their outgoing mail server is probably called, and this I've seen in like 99% of the cases, it's either going to be called mail.hotelisp.com or smtp.hotelisp.com. So if you're willing to, if they even offer an outgoing SMTP server and you can figure out the name of it, then you could plug that into your mail client and then you can send using that. So that's all. It's geeky, you know, which,
yeah.
But I don't think that's the best way to do it. And I think you have a better way of doing it, Dave.
Well, the way that I do it is I don't want to have to reconfigure my mail client every time I'm on some alternate network. And while this certainly goes back to the days when I was just traveling around with a laptop, it's a whole lot more important when traveling around with an iPhone, right? Because, you know, having to do all of this work on an iPhone just to figure out a mail server to get mail out is insanity, right? You just don't want to have that headache. You want to just send mail and walk away. You don't want to have to care. Am I on 3G? Am I on wireless? What wireless? How is it working? Who's the ISP? You might not even know how to do this on the iPhone because there isn't really a terminal unless you jailbreak the thing. So, you know, there's all kinds of wacky stuff that you'd have to do. So what I do is I recommend one of two things. Set up a mobile me account as your, you know, set up one account into which all your mail comes if you can. But if you can't, at the very least, set up one outgoing mail server and use it for everything. As long, and I'll use the caveat that as long as your corporate policies allow for this. If they don't, then you've got to set up your work email to go through one outbound server and then the rest of your email through another. But assuming you have the flexibility to do it, set it all up to go out through either a mobile me account, which is built to be used from anywhere, or from a Gmail account, which is also built to be used from anywhere. You would have to authenticate by typing in your username and password into your mail client. But then at that point, mail just sends out no matter where you are, and it's a pretty seamless experience. And it's exactly what you would expect it to work like. And you're just not thinking about it. Just like you can check mail from anywhere, you want to be able to send mail from anywhere. And that's the way to do it. Anything else, John, on that one?
I think we exhausted that one.
All right. So speaking of traveling, Tim has a question.
Hey, guys. Tim in Chicagoland once again. Just listening to 263 and wondering once again about the setup of an airport express for use in a hotel room. This topic comes up every now and then, and you guys sing praises and everything like that. My question is, how do you get this thing to navigate the hotel's sign-on system that says, yes, I accept the charges, or yes, I accept the, you know, the terms and conditions if it's free, along those lines. That way, I don't have to do that from whatever device that I'm connecting. Some devices like the iPod Touch or an iPhone or an iPad, obviously with a web browser, that doesn't seem to be a problem. But with something, say, like a gaming console that doesn't have a browser or some other device, how do you set this thing up to be in some semblance of default mode? And as Pete says, where you plug it in and it just turns green and grabs the IP address to where it's usable. So thanks again. Appreciate it. And great show. Still listening.
Thanks, Tim. All right, John, you want to take this one?
I think that we got some bad news here. I am not aware, this would actually be a cool little device to build here. Unless there's something I don't know here, Dave, you have to, whatever authentication system these guys are using, you must click on the checkbox and say, okay.
Right.
Before they do whatever they do in the background. I don't know if they give you a cookie or something that they flip some bit in the router that says, okay, now you can allow this person to get out. I don't know the details of the systems that do this, but, basically, you got to get something. So my recommendation is get the cheapest device you can get that has a web browser, like maybe an old, iPod Touch or something.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. Yeah, it's important to note that it's possible. I don't think anyone actually uses a cookie as the authentication method. And the reason is, while you can set a cookie in a web browser, that wouldn't necessarily authenticate an email client because there's no cookie to be read when you're sending and checking email. So I think what happens on most of these is that you fire up a web browser when you connect to the internet, and then it tries to request a web page. You're redirected to the web page of the hotel's choosing. You, as Tim said, agree or pay or both. And then it basically says, okay, this IP or this address is now allowed to browse the internet, at will. And once that happens, you're good to go. So the idea is, yes, like John said, you need a web browser, some device with a web browser, and a cheap iPod Touch is probably your best bet, unless you can find a Palm Pre that somebody threw away. What you want to do is you want to make sure that things are connected in a certain order. You want the hotel's network connected directly to your Airport Express or any other, whatever base station is. You don't have to use an Airport Express. So whatever base station it is, you have the hotel's network connected to that. And then make sure your devices, all of them, are connected wirelessly or wired to your router. Don't connect to the hotel's Wi-Fi network, because that's not going to do you any favors here. So, connect to your Airport Express and try and pull up a web page. You're going to be redirected. But once you authenticate, it now basically has said that Airport Express, not the device you're using, but that Airport Express is now free to use the network at will. And all the devices you connect to it are going to masquerade on the internet, just like they do when you're at home, as that one device, as that Airport Express. So that's what you need to do. But yeah, you got to have some way of agreeing to that. There's no ifs, ands, or buts on that one.
Yeah, and I'm with you, because I actually had one case where I think what I did by accident, but I convinced them to undo what happened, is typically the wireless will make a note of the MAC address of the device that's requesting access.
Okay.
And I had this happen one time where actually I think I fired up my MacBook Pro, connected to the wireless, and realized, oh, no, I want to use my own.
Right.
And what happened is, because it already had one MAC address assigned to my room, when I tried to then use the Airport Express to do the same thing,
right,
it said, oh, sorry, who are you? You're someone else. I'm going to charge you more. I'm going to charge you as if you were a separate device or a separate machine.
Sure.
Which it was, but then I think when I went down to the desk later on, they're like, it appeared twice on my bill. And I think I said, dude, I only have one computer. How could this happen? Feigning ignorance.
Yeah.
They said, oh, well, that makes sense. Of course, sir. We'll take that extra charge off.
Yeah, they've gotten a lot smarter about that now that it's not uncommon for us all to have the same, all to have multiple devices. So, I've seen it displayed pretty explicitly in hotel rooms that you will be charged, X amount per day per device, even with a caption, or a parenthetical that says, and that includes phones and, PDAs, et cetera, et cetera. So,
Yeah,
so you're definitely better off. This week at the Intercontinental, I connected my laptop to the Ethernet there, And then when I was in the room, I just shared the Ethernet from my laptop, just because the Ethernet connection was so good. I mean, it, like I said, that one night it was pretty tight, but, as everybody was downloading all the new stuff, but otherwise it was great there. So worked out well. All right. Let's do I want to talk about our second sponsor, which is GoToAssist Express from Citrix. Same people that do web meeting and all of that stuff. Citrix has GoToAssist Express, which is a way of connecting to another computer remotely and very easily, I might add. When John and I tested it here, I logged into GoToAssist Express on my end. I created a link. Created a session, and then that generated a URL. And so I passed that URL. It was just a normal HTTP, :// URL. I sent that to John. Meanwhile, I waited, as it said, waiting for the other party to begin the session. Soon as John opened that URL, he was asked to agree to what was about to happen. And then, boom, I had access to his machine. John could see what I was doing. I could control it. John could stop me at any time, but otherwise, free access over the internet, didn't have to go and muck with port forwarding on either one of our firewalls. We didn't even have to think about the fact that we were both behind routers. It just simply worked. And that's because we both started the session from within our web browser. It wasn't like I tried to remotely start the session on John's machine. So GoToAssist Express from Citrix, is the way to do this. You can get 30 days for free by visiting GoToAssist 30 days free at GoToAssist.com/gab. That's GAB. GoToAssist.com/gab gets you 30 days free of GoToAssist Express from Citrix. And with that, Guy has a question. We just can't let go.
Hey, John and Dave, it's Guy from the MyMac.com podcast. I just recently got a letter from one of our listeners, and his basic problem was that he has an older Core Duo iMac, 17-inch, that he wants to install Boot Camp and Windows on, but it's a little tight at only 80 gigs. And he wanted to know whether he could put Windows on an external drive using Boot Camp and go ahead and use it that way. And, I looked online, and there was a couple ways to do it. But it seemed to be a little more complicated than what he probably wanted to do, involved disconnecting the internal drive, modifying the Windows installer, so on and so on. But I thought of a couple of different ones, and I wanted to run them past you. The easy one, of course, is to replace the internal drive with one that's much bigger, which isn't a bad idea with only an 80-gig drive anyway, and then install Boot Camp and Windows as normal. The second thing I thought of was to make a very small partition using disk utility for just the Windows OS, no apps, and then use the external like a D drive. And the last thing I thought of kind of scared me, and I wanted to run this past you first, see what you thought, and that was to combine his internal and external drives into one partition using disk utility. Back up all of his data first, combine the drives, and then reformat, and then you'll boot back up and use that one partition and install OS X from either his backup or from the drive, and then Boot Camp and Windows. Now, I'm not sure how this would work on startup if OS X was across two drives. Maybe it would also depend on whether the drive was USB or FireWire, and it would probably require you to always hold down the Option key on startup to force the computer to examine all available drives before booting. And, of course, if he lost either drive, he would be toast as far as all of his data goes. I thought that might make a fun weekend project for people with more money and time than sense. And the fact that I even thought of this says a lot about the potential for the Dr. Frankenstein in me. Anyway, that's all I got. I'd really like to know what you guys think. This is where you don't cut me off. I can be reached at guy@mymac.com. Thanks again. Bye.
Thanks, Guy. Always good to hear from you, man. So, hearing this and hearing your thought process behind it, Guy, definitely, it reaffirmed my knowledge of who exactly you are, because the Dr. Frankenstein was plain as day in that description, especially the last one, but even in the second one. you know, John, my feeling on this is you don't do number three. I don't even know if number three is possible, but if Guy thinks it is, it probably is, because he is Dr. Frankenstein when it comes to this stuff.
My reaction to number three was, what are you, nuts? No, actually, yeah. That gets great respect from me. Now, actually, I'm looking here very quickly, Dave, and I do believe you can do that, because I'm actually looking right now at my G5. So what he was saying when he said combine drives, now, of course, I'm not going to do this, because that would bring our podcast to an abrupt end.
Screeching halt. That's right.
But no, I'm looking here. So what he's saying when he said combine the drives is this utility gives you the ability to create a RAID array. Okay. So I think he was proposing was stitching the drives together to make two RAID. One thing that RAID can do is to make one or more drives appear as a single drive when in fact they are multiple physical drives.
Right.
And I believe what you would do, and they have three choices here right now, Dave. There's a mirrored RAID set, a striped, and a concatenated set. I think this would be a
concatenated
disk set.
Yep.
And I'm looking here, and it's allowing me to define a RAID set, and I dragged over an external drive, which we can go into the story of how I accomplished this. But I have right now on this computer both, I have two internal drives and an external drive, and it, I'm not going to click on the create button again. This could, this would bring things to a halt, but it appears to let me drag both internal and external drives. The external drive is a FireWire 800 drive. Wow. I would say you could do it. I mean, it sounds adventurous.
That scares the life out of me.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, that's kind of what RAID does. I mean, the computer shouldn't care, but to me, that would make me very uneasy, because the risk, of course, is if one or the other drive dies and you're just doing a simple, you know, ching without any sort of error correction, then your setup is shot. So, I will give that. I'm giving that solution geek points for creativity, because I would have never thought doing that.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. It surprises me that works, but not really. Like I said, because if Guy thought it worked, it's probably because he's done it. So that speaks volumes about those guys at MyMac. It's cool what you know, that they're willing to dig in and just do crazy things. I like that. So solution one or two, either way you're partitioning the drive, right? Because that's part of what boot camp is. I would go with a bigger drive, but if you already have an external drive, I think option number two is actually pretty cool, where you do a very, very bare bones, you know, just enough for the OS install of Windows, and then use an external drive as your D drive, as it were. I think that's cool, but I'd go with option number one.
I would prefer option number one. Just to, you know, if you're running out of space anyways, you might as well. So option number one is the one that I would do, though I give the other two points for a creative way to approach the problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's get into some follow-ups here from our previous shows. We had, the first thing I want to do, I got quite a few emails about my little rant about ad blocking and all that stuff. To be fair, I don't believe that blocking Flash is a bad thing. In fact, I encourage you all to do it. At Backbeat Media, we tell all of our advertisers, we advise them not to use Flash, because so many people block it, and it, you know, runs so poorly on the Mac in general that you only want to run Flash when you choose to. You don't want to have it, you know, poured into your machine. So just to be clear, you know, it, as far as I'm concerned, blocking Flash is not akin to blocking ads, even though the result of it may be that you wind up blocking some ads. We talked in the previous show in 265 about unsupported scanners and Snow Leopard, and we got quite a few emails from people. I'll mention one of the things, and John, you've got another thing. ViewScan from Hamrick, HAMRICK.com. Is a third-party scanner driver. I believe it's only for USB scanners. It would not find my networked HP LaserJet 3055, but it probably would find it if I plugged it in USB. I just did not try that. But lots of people, Neil and William, actually plenty of them. And they say it's kept up to date and it works just fine. And so, and I think it's $39 and you get updates for a year, or you can pay $79 and get updates for a lifetime. So, so that's ViewScan from Hamrick. Definitely, definitely worth talking about. And then John, you found, Monday's Mac Gadget about another one a little while back, right?
Yes, I did. So this is the free option. I think playing with something like ViewScan would be the way to go if you want to get the most support, but this is probably worth a try here. I found something, and as you pointed out, there's an article on it called Twain Sane. Now here we have acronym soup here. So what is Sane, you ask? Well, Sane is an open source project.
You didn't let me ask. What is Sane, John?
Well, Sane is an open source project called, which stands for Scanner Access Now Easy. Isn't that clever? And then, of course, Twain, as we discussed, is technology without an interesting name. But basically, this product, it's called Twain Sane. It's a freebie. It is supported under Snow Leopard. I just looked at the page here. And basically, it is an attempt to give you Twain support on scanners that would otherwise not support Twain. And as we discussed, the benefit of a Twain scanner versus something that has proprietary drivers, a Twain driver will let you use a number of programs, including Graphic Converter, Image Capture, OmniPage, Word, Photoshop, I think, you know, a whole bunch of things, will be able to deal with the scanner. So I didn't look for the particular model of scanner, but this is certainly worth exploring. The most it'll take is a little bit of your time. I don't think it'll hurt anything. I tried it with a Fujitsu I have, which is I like their included software, but you know, I just like the options of being able to use other programs rather than their program to pull images from the scanner. And it had a few hiccups here and there, but again, worth a shot. And the price is right.
Cool. All right. So we also talked about grounding policies, our grounding policies, meaning not our parenting policies and how I choose to stop my children from going out when they do something wrong. But grounding in terms of working on a computer and what to do when. And we got quite a few emails and we wanted to acknowledge all of them. Saying that, you know, by not using a grounding strap and even worse, leaving a desktop machine or any machine, but a desktop machine plugged in when working on it is not advisable. And that's fine. And it is good to read up on this stuff and make your own decision. Jason sent a audio comment through that I think is worth sharing here.
Dave and John, this is Jason. I do work at the Apple Store as a genius there, and just to give a quick comment about the grounding and how working on computers, the process that Apple makes us follow there is we actually have a mat there that's grounded itself, and regardless of any computer, always unplug everything, including when we do the laptops, we unplug the battery, and we wear the grounding strip that's actually attached to the mat, and so that we're grounded. And the computer lays on the mat that's grounded. So we never have them plugged in. When we go through training, that's the first thing they tell us to do is unplug before we work on anything. So just to give that comment, that's how we do it there. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. So, John, go ahead. I know you've got something to say here, right? I assume.
Well, I would say, yeah. So I'm going to revise. What I said here. I actually looked online and there was a site, can't remember off the top of my head here, but I actually found an article that, you know, where the people that wrote it went to a number of people that run computer service places and asked, you know, their opinion of what they should do. And for the most part, most places said, leave it unplugged. There were a couple, but the majority of people said, leave it unplugged. The thing, of course, with if it's plugged in, however slight, especially if the the thing is the voltages coming out of the power supply are not going to hurt anybody. You know, it's typically 12 volts and 5 volts. That's not going to hurt anybody. However, in the incredibly unlikely event that there is a malfunction in the power supply, 120 volts. I don't know about you, Dave. I mean, when I was a kid, I stuck a fork in an outlet and I'm still here to tell the tale, but you,
but 120 volts isn't what it used to be.
Yeah. But anyways, so I'm going to modify my position and say you should unplug. Even though that's what both you and I do, from this point on, if I work on a desktop machine, I'm going to leave it unplugged. You still want to ground it, though. I mean, and right. That's what everybody's saying. So,
right.
And as multiple people told us, the best solution is to get one of these anti-static mats, which has something that typically goes to the center screw on the outlet, which is ground or should be ground. Now, you may also want to make sure that your ground is correct. And they sell these little devices like a Radio Shack and other electronics stores, which will tell you if your outlet is configured properly.
Yeah, that's
it's not
a good
guaranteed.
Point.
I mean, yeah. It's not guaranteed that the center screw on your outlet is going to ground. It should, even if you have a third prong. Somebody may have not installed it properly. So right. You may want to do that too, just to verify. Now, the one thing you want to be very careful of, and although these are not in fashion anymore, this is definitely something you want to be very, very careful with, and I'll have to find a way to deal with this. But CRTs, which again, I think most people are not using tube monitors or cathode ray tubes is what they're called, had this little thing in there called a flyback transformer.
And is it called flyback, John, because that's what happens to you when you touch one?
Well, it certainly could, but then this gets incredibly dangerous because a CRT, what the flyback transformer basically does is take the incoming voltage, 120 or otherwise, and increase it, because what the tube does, it needs more than 120 volts. And especially if some of that energy is stored somewhere, either in the transformer or capacitor or something in there, you could kill yourself by messing around with the monitor. So I would say, first off, you know, I mean, if you got a CRT, I mean, you know, if it's broken, chuck it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't see any compelling reason to get a CRT over a LCD, especially in this day and age, whether it be price. I mean, you know, they consume more power.
I know that there are those out there that care about color matching, and I don't believe that you're going to get color matching accuracy anywhere else other than in a CRT. So there are still quite a bit of CRTs sold to that high end community, and they're not cheap. So there is the instinct is, well, if it's broken, let's fix it. And that's fine. But have it fixed by someone that knows exactly what they're doing. Do not open it up. I think it can hold that charge for 6 months to a year. Right. Or maybe more. Right. I mean, I know it holds it for a very, very long time. It's not just unplug it and that's that. So.
Right. I'm hearing a little feedback.
Yeah, no, you know, I thought that was feedback, too. It's actually my iPhone ringing. And I have it on mute, but it's on the desk.
I guess
my mic stand is just nudged up against the desk. So that's what that was. It was not feedback. I thought you were humming, John.
Yeah. So definitely a CRT or tube, only if you know what you're doing. I would not even try to work on when I had them. If there was something wrong with it, I wouldn't even think of going inside. Well, I may have once just to see what's inside of there, but definitely with the power off and not touching anything. So,
yeah.
Thanks everybody for, and it was good to learn the Apple people, how they do it.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. You know, we got one other thing that we'll throw in here from an interesting use case for an iPad that I thought was, I'm an audio guy. I'm a musician. So this sort of, you know, very near and dear to my heart. But anyway, here we go.
Dave and John, this is Dave from Saugerties Woodstock. Second time I'm trying to leave this message because I'm calling Skype from Skype on 3G. And it didn't make it all the way through the call before. But I was just calling to talk about 266 that I just started listening to. And comments about the iPad as a travel companion. I bought mine in Chicago. I'm a sound engineer. I do a lot of touring. And I bought mine in Chicago when I was out on the road, and with the intention of taking it to London in a couple of days after that to integrate it via Jadu VNC, or iTeleport now, integrate it into controlling the Yamaha digital console that I was working on in London. In order to kind of walk around the venue and do sound checks remotely using the iPad. So that was my idea. That was my initial intention for the reason I wanted to buy it. mainly because I could then justify it as a business deduction. And when I got to London, we tried it, hooked up the laptop to the console, and it worked flawlessly. A little bit of latency, a little bit of jumpiness, but for the most part, it worked great. I was on stage tweaking monitors. I was up in the balcony tweaking EQ, and it was probably the most amazing, coolest thing. There are other PC tablets that work with these consoles like this, but nothing is as nice as the way the iPad is working.
That's awesome.
So that was the main reason why I bought it. However, it took me about a week to sort of warm up to the other functions on it. I felt a little goofy at first pulling it out in public because of the size of it, and just, you know, it wasn't really a very, very common thing yet. Not a whole lot of people had seen it. But once I did warm up to it, the travel factor, like you were saying, Dave, is just great. It's the best travel companion I could imagine. It's you know, I've been reading a couple of books on it. I'm in the middle of reading Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, which is an awesome book. I'm reading that. I read another kind of trash novel before that. And I've watched some movies on the planes, done tons of emails. One of the flights I was on, I think it was a Delta flight that had in-flight internet. It was great, sir.
And I think that's at the point at which 3G and Skype no longer got along. So thanks for sharing that story, Dave. That's actually pretty cool. Pretty cool use case for the iPad and for a tablet in general. So I think, John, I think that's all we wrote.
Oh, that's what my clock says.
Yeah. Feedback@macgeekgab.com is the email address to which you can send all of your feedback.
I believe you said, well, you know, I'm going to differ with you on that, Dave, and I would rather send it to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Oh, no. Feedback@macgeekgab.com. Unless, of course, you're a premium subscriber, send it to premium@macgeekgab.com. And I will say about the premium subscription, we did make a migration to a new payment system recently. I think it's working very, very well. But you know, there's several of you every day that convert up to the premium, and we certainly very much, in fact, appreciate that. But you know, send us a note. Let us know how the process was. If you thought it could have been a little better or smoother, if you really liked it, just send us a note to premium@macgeekgab.com. That's something we were looking for feedback on, that just to make sure that's working for you, like it's working for us. $25 for 6 months. You can't beat it. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number to which you can send, you can call and leave messages, much like Dave did, and and various other people on the show here.
Yeah, I think that's 4335.
That's right. Excellent. Good catch, John. You can Skype to Mac Geek Gab, and then you can leave us iTunes comments. We can't reply to those, but we do like seeing them. Both positive and negative, as long as they're constructive. I do want to say one thing, and that is, as best as you can, please be concise with your emails and phone messages. You know, all the stuff that you've heard in the show today, it certainly fits into that realm just fine. But we do get some emails that are just, you know, 4-5 pages long. And to be quite honest, we don't always have the time to go through it, and certainly don't have the time in the show to read a 5-page email. So if it is something we want to discuss, now we've got to chop it down and all that stuff. So as best, and I know some things take a lot to explain, and if it takes a lot to explain, do that. But if you can, chop them down try and make it as concise as possible. That makes our job easier, and frankly, it significantly increases your chances of getting an answer from us. Even if it's not an answer on the show, we do often answer most of the emails that come through. The only ones that we wind up kind of glossing over are those that are, you know, 5 pages long. And if we've got, you know, another 200 emails backed up behind yours, it's like, well, I got to come back around to this one because I got to get through everything else. So that's just the reality of the way it is. I wish it were different, but it's not. Mm-hmm. So.
And sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Absolutely.
Sometimes not.
That's right. Yes.
No, but sometimes, and we found more often than not, I think that screenshots and things like that help explain a problem better than, you know, you retyping it in when you can show us. And, you know, details always, you know, try to you know, try to give us as much detail as you can. If you're, you know, as far as the OS version, the machine, you know, things like that. Don't assume we know your setup.
Sure.
Although we may, because, well, we're watching.
That's right. All right. Thanks, folks. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. The We Have Communicators Process podcast from Michael Johnston is where he is when he's not converting this show. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. Podcast Marketplace is the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine. The Ojimbo from Barebone Software. Text Expander from Smile on My Mac. Notebook from Circus Ponies. And GoToAssist.com/Gab from Citrix. All through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And do not get caught.
Made up.